Welcome to the Experience Focused Leaders Podcast. My name is Alex Shevelenko. I'm CEO and founder of Relate2, and we are on a mission, both with the podcast and with Relate2, to bring the most important ideas to life. And how do we do that? We do that through amazing, immersive, engaging experiences that move your organization forward, move your customers forward, and move us as a society forward. So if you love ideas, if you love bringing these ideas to life, stick around. Also, at the end of the podcast, we'll reveal how you could potentially be a guest speaker on the podcast as well. Let's get started. I am very excited to welcome Elizabeth Weingarten, a journalist, applied behavioral scientist, and author of How to Fall in Love with Questions. At the same time, I'm a little bit afraid that I'm not going to ask the right perfect questions of you, Elizabeth. So you have to help me. And I think, we're all understand that curiosity is where it's at in this day and age of everything changing all the time. But how do we be curious more effectively is probably going to be a huge takeaway for our audience, and what's worth being curious about and what's not worth being curious about as well. So over to you. Tell us what led you to write the book.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, I've definitely heard that before. Let me just take the pressure off that I'm sure you're going to ask great questions. And we were talking a little bit earlier about, I think the worst thing that you could do is just not ask any questions, right? Yeah. And the origin story of the book actually starts when I was in DC. I was single, I was dating men, and found that I kept going on dates with men who did not ask a single question. And this happened over and over and over again. And it led me to, at first I was really frustrated, as you know, you would be, but it led me to get really curious about question asking, the power of question asking, why questions are so important, not only in our personal lives, but in our professional lives. Mm-hmm. And the kind of long story short of this is that I got really curious about question asking from this kind of perspective of an applied behavioral scientist and journalist. But it wasn't until I started going through some real significant personal challenges that the shape of the book really kind of started to come together. This was during the pandemic. I had this interest in questions, but I was asking really big questions in my life at that point. One, I had recently gotten married. The marriage was failing. And I was asking this question of, should I get a divorce? Big, heavy question. Yeah. I had also recently left.
And this is before ChatGPT. So you didn't have your listening assistant in the
Exactly. Box. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I was also asking this question of, what am I doing with my life? Because I had recently left a job to pursue this creative project that was failing. Mm-hmm. And so I'm holding on to these big, heavy questions. And it was around this time that I found a book called Letters to a Young Poet. And we can talk a little bit about this. But this book was totally transformative, in part because there's a passage in it where a poet, Rainier Maria Rilke, I don't know, are you familiar with Rilke at all? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So he's this poet writing to an aspiring poet and encouraging him to, quote, love the questions themselves as if they were locked rooms or books written in a foreign tongue. And Alex, I loved this idea of loving the questions. And yet in my own life, I was like, I hate these questions. I hate these questions in my life. I had never felt further away from loving the questions. And so the book that I wrote is really this exploration of how do we actually love the questions of our life? Is that even possible, right? Like, especially the big questions. And how do we do it, especially in a culture in which so many of us have become addicted to fast, easy answers? And so that's really what the book is about. And a big part of it is, how do we form a different relationship to uncertainty, right? Because the world is, you know, more uncertain every day. And so how do we basically grapple with that?
So since you started with relatively not the most modern of poets, let's go back to Socrates. And you know, every law student, probably some journalist students, are being trained in the Socratic method, and it feels almost like you're saying we've lost that that strain of education that has been there about asking questions and guiding the question, you know, that the question guides us to the real insight, or is there something else going on, right? Like the because it's not it's it sounds ridiculous, right, to ask to realize that if the Western civilization was based under these guys like Socrates or Plato in this particular case that were articulating that this is the discipline we have, you know, I'd say there's streams in business. We had a guest who's written a book and kind of guidelines on curiosity-based selling, right? And teaches a class at Stanford on that. So there's some strains there from all the way to Socrates to, you know, the latest business schools where people are focused on the topic of curiosity. And yet, like we have this gap, like with the one that you've experienced. And how do we explain this?
Yeah, so I think you're right that there are, various places in our culture where curiosity is thriving. And I think there is a whole kind of school of thought that yes, questions are really important in business. And also, I think what exists alongside that is a culture that valorizes people that have the answers, right? The people that are confident. And that still, people inside of organizations feel really uncomfortable saying, I don't know. And so I think on the one hand, you have people that really romanticize question asking and curiosity. And then those same people are in meetings with, their subordinates and they're demanding answers. And so I think there's a real kind of disconnect in terms of, yeah, sure, we can all say questions are great, right? You and I are sitting here talking about how great questions are, but where the rubber hits the road is when we're really worried about something, when we're anxious about something, when there is fear and stakes in the conversation. And that's what I was really interested in my work is how do you open up space for curiosity when the stakes get
When the
really high?
stakes are higher, right? Like when
Exactly.
it's not like, oh yeah, cause,
Let's
you
just
know, tell me about
explore
your
what's going
childhood
on.
type of thing,
Right,
right? Like,
right. Or just like
that's weak.
we're in a safe brainstorming session and this is meant for, we're it's like I think that is the place where a lot of people don't want to go there and admit that they're really uncomfortable with curiosity and uncertainty when, we've all had those moments where we just feel so much pressure to just have an answer. And so those are the moments that are most where you're most at risk for seizing a fast, easy answer that's actually not going to be the right solution and the best decision for you.
And as a behavioral scientist, what do you find underneath, whether it's from cognitive and neuroscience or kind of more social sciences perspective, what is driving that need for certainty when
Yeah.
it's met with or higher?
So I think there's some really interesting science that looks at how our brains evolved and how we're wired. And there's something called selfish brain theory. And the idea behind that is our brains were really wired for when food was scarce. And as a result, we are generally trying to choose paths that require less metabolic energy, require less fuel. Certainty, predictability requires less energy. It's, just think about yourself on autopilot, right? You're not expending that much energy. Uncertainty, on the other hand, takes more calories. It's just harder for our bodies and for our brains to kind of navigate. So as a result, we're coding uncertainty in our environments as something that is aversive, something that we want to avoid. And that's like a primary kind of driver behind that feeling of, ugh, uncertainty. I just need to resolve this immediately. And I need to get this away. And so you kind of that's the basis of it. And then psychologists have coined, that experience of like I need to just get this. I need to resolve this uncertainty as the need for closure. A psychologist, Ari Kruglansky and others created this need for closure scale to basically assess how much you feel in that moment of uncertainty. You need to get an answer. The other side of the scale is avoidance, right? Where you're just like, I'm not committing at all. Ideally, you want to find some kind of balance, but The one other thing I'll say is that your need for closure, your sense of wanting to resolve that uncertainty is going to differ across situations, right? So maybe you're somebody who at work, you actually have a pretty high uncertainty tolerance, but
Right.
at home in your personal life, you have zero tolerance for
Right.
uncertainty.
Right.
And this is something that came up a lot in my interviews and in my research was that it really it's based on lots of different factors and it's highly situational.
And I would imagine also if you look at something like Big Five personality theory,
Yeah.
there are some people that are a lot more on, on the scale of just being open to things not
Totally.
form, right? And then if you apply that to cultures, let's say if you're in LATAM, some cultures where there is just inherently a lot of uncertainty, people are, like Lebanon is kind of a great example of people building resilience systems to cope with uncertainty. And so is that something that you've unlocked in your work? So people that come from that either cultural predisposition or personal predisition are capable.
Yes, it's the short answer is personality does have a little bit to do with it. Openness to experience, as you pointed out, is one of the factors that's most closely related to how comfortable we feel in uncertainty. Culturally, I did uncover some research, but frankly, it wasn't as robust as I would have wanted it to be. I didn't include it in my book for that reason, because I just couldn't kind of substantiate some of the, there were findings from one organization that had conducted some cultural research. And I think part of it is that there's a tremendous amount of complexity when it comes to thinking about how a particular country or culture responds to uncertainty that I think is it's very hard to just say, oh, this culture has this perspective or because I think you can also imagine that somebody from a culture that is highly uncertain, you can imagine multiple reactions to that uncertainty, right? You could imagine somebody who to your point, maybe they do develop a higher tolerance or a sense of resilience. Or on the flip side, they might just, be so averse to it that they're
They're
seeking
so
control.
traumatized that they want to like
They
reduce
want to
it.
control everything and they don't, so I think it's really hard to make those kinds of conclusions. But I'm curious for you. I mean, when you think about you're obviously, a leader, a founder. What's your own relationship to uncertainty? How would you kind of, where would you put yourself on that like need for closure scale?
I think I would agree with your assessment that there is a continuum in general. So I'm probably as a founder, we would tend to be on the higher end of, being open to uncertainty. And there's a self-selection happening. I think also I would say experiences such as immigration creates a bar, in my view, of being able to refer to situations in the past where you or your family were able to handle uncertainty. And as you know, once it's a muscle to some degree. So if you've kind of stretched the art of the possible, I think it's higher. So if you're in the particular community, or surrounded by people during your formative years who have taken uncertainty, that's kind of another dimension. Third, I would say, it's funny, I went to two business schools. One was an undergrad, I was at Penn. Wharton was kind of one of the majors. So it's, a lot of folks there were going straight to Goldman Sachs. They kind of knew there were three. And then the second, I went to MBA at Stanford, and the Stanford promoted uncertainty a lot more because much more entrepreneurial and much more Silicon Valley. Whereas I think the Wharton had that strain of like entrepreneurial, but there, at least for undergrads, there was like, hey, you need to manage the downside. These are the top career tracks, and this is sort of for like this is the path. There was kind of more of a notion of a path, and so it was embrace like there was a lot more focus on de-risking your initial a few years after school. So why am I bringing this up? I think I would say when I started out, I had, maybe went more traditional with some proclivity to exploring and, backpacking and doing other things. And then as I kind of progressed over time and pursued more entrepreneurial ventures, I think you just become more tolerant. And so almost to the point where some people just actually take on experiments of like, how do you take on more uncertainty to train it? So for example, after business school, I had a small exit during and after. I just said, I'm going to travel around the world. That was a dream. And I'm going to create extra challenges. Like, I'm not going to know when until I land in a country or a city, I'm not going to know where I stay. I'm not going to have anything planned. And I'm just going to create these uncertain experiences. So for some people, it's a gamification. And so I would put myself on that in that category. And then at the same time, once you have kids, once you have a lot more complexity, once you have a company to run, then it's a little it's kind of you get pulled back into reality and gravity of responsibility. So I don't I find that it's an ongoing challenge, right? Like, kind of where do you balance it? Is that a pattern that you're seeing as well, Elizabeth?
Yeah, well, I think it's I appreciate what you shared, and I think you brought up something that I think is really important, which is this idea of uncertainty tolerance as a muscle.
Yeah.
And it's something that has come up again and again, and in particular when it comes to the role that our technology is playing in, in some cases, like kind of atrophying that muscle, right? And there's a researcher who I spoke to for the book, and I actually spoke to several other researchers for a story that's coming out soon about this topic, just about the fact that, it's always been hard for us to tolerate uncertainty, but now, kind of in the AI age, especially having kind of devices and agents around us at all times that are able to alleviate any uncertainty that we have, answer any question that we have. On the one hand, it's really great in some cases. On the other hand, it takes away these everyday moments and opportunities to strengthen our uncertainty muscles. And so it requires that we really become a lot more kind of intentional about building those muscles in our lives, right? And making sure that, yes, do I use AI all the time. It's great. But I also have to be aware of the way that it's impacting my own ability to tolerate uncertainty. Because if you think about it as a muscle and all of these everyday moments, like for instance, and not just AI, but just looking up anything and reducing uncertainty ahead of time. So I don't know if you're somebody that does this, but like anytime I go to a restaurant, I look up the menu ahead of time, right? You like look at everything on the menu, you decide what you want to eat, all these things. And it's like that's just one little moment of uncertainty that maybe you could tolerate, right? And that you could go and you could not look, or maybe, you're in a new city. Instead of yelping everything, they, like maybe you just walk into a place and you see what happens. So there are all sorts of moments, in our daily lives where we can practice this and build up that tolerance. So when the big high stakes moments arrive, we have a stronger foundation to work with.
Well, you obviously know the sort of the range between maximizers and satisfizers. So obviously the reduction of uncertainty, feeds our maximizer tendency. Because basically it says the decision of where I eat on lunch on Tuesday has to be this sort of big research project where you could spend as much time on it as you would looking for a car, right? And I think now we are enabled with it. And I think the other observation that I just had as you were describing is, the classical example of the kind of super successful story of Uber is that the reason Uber was successful is it removed the uncertainty about the when the car would arrive, right? Because it was giving you this sort of sense of control. And so we're kind of, because you may not, it may not be in exactly 10 minutes, but at least you kind of you know what it is, and it was taxis, you don't know if they'll show up, et cetera, et cetera. And so the more Uber, like everybody was saying, we are Uber for this and we're Uber for that. And we're, the more we live in that world, you're right, the more we get untrained. And my takeaway is that the high stakes part really shakes you up much more in a personal stuff than at work. But there are certainly work decisions, and entrepreneurs tend to identify with their company as a baby. So that there is that. I think it's easier to untrain that identification than it is maybe to as a parent, or as a spouse or as a son, like where you have a set of expectations, that are built in that you may not even be conscious about. And then when they get shaken up, that's where you get all uncomfortable. And we're not trained to ask those questions unless you're doing a lot of meditation, for example.
Well, what I often say is that, when it comes to tolerating uncertainty, the personal is the professional, right? And it's like you can't actually change the way that you tolerate professional uncertainty unless you start with that kind of personal sphere. And first, your relationship to yourself, which sounds a little bit, squishy, but it's actually the one of the things that I found from my work is that your relationship to uncertainty and these kind of big questions is a direct reflection of your relationship to yourself. Because your relationship to uncertainty at the end of the day is all about how do I regulate my own emotions? How do I kind of deal with myself and talk to myself when the stakes get high, when I'm afraid? And so to do that, you have to, ultimately, a lot of times it does start with those kind of personal experiences, those personal questions, because to your point, those are the things that often create the most kind of anxiety, concern, worry, right? The things that are can be harder to tolerate. And so, a lot of the stories that I tell and the science that I bring in the book are about people that are kind of grappling on with questions that extend from the personal to the professional. They're questions about your sense of self-worth outside of your accomplishments. They're questions about, how much do you give yourself over to your kind of professional life, and the expense of your personal life. And so I think these are things that they can feel detached from the day-to-day, but they're actually so core to how you show up and to how you're making decisions. And so, when you are in that high stakes, high pressure moment, if you're a leader, it's the difference between being able to, like pause in that moment and say, okay, I know myself pretty well right now, and I know that I'm feeling really anxious. I'm feeling really concerned about this. And instead of just kind of compulsively trying to get an answer or make a decision, how do I take a moment and make sure that A, I'm asking the right question here, and B, that I'm kind of creating the right conditions and circumstances to allow the right question and the right answer to emerge. And one of the big things that I talk about in the book is kind of a framework for being able to do that, to figure out, am I asking the right question? And how do I create, the architecture and the circumstances on my team to help people continue to move forward and find clarity, in the unknown.
Let's come back to the questions and the framework, but like this step, first step, right? The foundational step of how do you get to even be curious in the first place? So I think what you're implying, if I read it correctly, is that when we are anxious or afraid, we want to control the environment, because we are not okay was whatever happens, unless what happens is what we want or we think we want to happen. So the people that I admire are, in the entrepreneurial or maybe even as again in these personal contexts, and try to model myself on are the ones that basically say, hey, no matter what happens in this situation, it's going to be okay. And it sounds kind of obvious, but obviously when it's high stakes, right? Like, so we're not talking about picking a restaurant, but some people get worked up about a restaurant as well, right? Like, but we're talking about like my kids are yelling or fighting with each other. That one
Yes.
drove me crazy because I just didn't come out. I came in and like I grew up in an environment where I couldn't as easily articulate my demands as a kid because it was kind of Soviet Union era, long time ago parenting. So I mean, my mental model, this sort of aggressive articulation of needs of kids and then kids fighting with each other over this, and it was made me very, very uncomfortable. And so when you're uncomfortable, you lack the curiosity and you want to say, hey, you can't yell like this, you gotta stop, right? Like this is too much, right? Like there's this is you so you're basically shoving your answer, your idea of what's right or wrong. And this could be in how do you get to revenue in a corporate environment or all sorts of applications. But I just thought this was really interesting because if you are okay with whatever kids are doing or your partner is doing, then you could then say, hey, I wonder what's happening for you that's
Yes.
causing this, what's underneath this? Because typically that's just their own reaction. But there's this gap that, as you pointed out, that you need to be to get yourself to that point, because the initial reaction is to maybe like avoid some uncomfort, right? Like that before we get curious. So what's the master move for people to get to that, even start asking questions in the first place?
Yeah, so it's a really good question, and I think you've kind of hit it on the head, which is in those moments of like tension and fear and stress, and I'm a mother too, and so there are so many times during the day when I find myself just feeling overwhelmed by the chaos, right? And just wanting to like I just want to control it. And that is completely deflates curiosity, because all of a sudden, to your point, you're just projecting your own answers, your own sense of wanting to kind of move towards a particular outcome in the situation. And so what you're doing in that moment is you are holding yourself back from learning. And so kind of one of the things that one of the very simple ways to change how you show up in those moments, it's very, very simple, right? It can sometimes just be as simple as taking a brief pause and saying, And this comes from the work of Judson Brewer, who wrote a book called Unwinding Anxiety. And it's all about how do you create that space for curiosity in between that, fear or anxiety response. And that's the key point, is like if you think about, yourself and you just become completely enmeshed in your own feelings, right? Like, how do you just create a little crack in that, and so you can just like, and then asking a question, right, in that moment. And maybe for you, the question is, I wonder what's really going on here. Or maybe the question is, like I really want this to happen, but is there another outcome that could be okay? Or, there are lots of different questions that you might ask, but I think the key thing is, A, like it's something that can keep you kind of anchored in the present moment. And I think that's the real key and the real reason that curiosity can be so powerful, is you're trying to learn more about what's happening right now, what is the moment that I'm in right now, versus I think the fear and the anxiety comes from extrapolating and trying to predict the future, right? It's just like, if my kids don't stop screaming, we're not going to get to this event on time, or people are going to think this, or this is going to happen. You're just kind of like going through all these scenarios in your head of what's going to happen, and which you don't know. You don't know if any of that's going to happen. And instead of being aware,
Or I would just add, or avoid the past. So you have
or avoid the past.
something
Totally.
happened in the past, and you're like, ah, I don't want that, in the
Totally. You're
so
time
you're kind of
traveling.
going there or there. And what
Exactly.
you're
Exactly.
saying is you're and those what I hear you're saying is those are sort of they're kind of cerebral memories, but they get you into your crocodile brain. So you're kind of like really trying to to avoid it as you know as much as possible, because you're, again, you're in the fear mode, your reactive mode, or
Exactly. You're
attacking mode of that, against that, right?
yes, and you're not, I think, like if you like think about any like superhero movie that you've ever seen or any like action movie, right? How does the character manage to escape the villain and do all the things? They don't do it by like have, worrying or thinking about the past. They are so present in the moment, right? They're like looking at the space that they're in. They're like, huh, okay, I see that. I see that. Oh, this is going on here. They are masters of observation and of curiosity, of observing their surroundings. And so that's the mindset, I think, for these moments, where you're compulsively wanting to like, okay, let me just do this. Let me just like, I'm feeling this pain in this moment. I'm just gonna try to solve it the way that I did it in the past, or I'm just gonna try to control it versus like, how can I learn about what's happening now and how do I get curious about this? Which is the harder, higher order thing, but ultimately it's the thing that, maybe in those moments with your kids or with a challenging board meeting or whatever it is. Taking that moment to pause and try to understand like what's actually happening. I think about this a lot in the context of you're in a meeting with your board or with a senior leader who's asking you really tough questions and you don't know the answers or you're stumbling or something. Taking the time to understand like, okay, but what's behind this
What's
question that they're
behind this question
asking,
exactly?
right? What are they
It's
really trying to
really
get at?
sales with customers. This is a very interesting thing. So there's, we almost like, oh great, I get to answer the question, check.
Yeah,
I'm accomplished, and we're all like in the accomplished universe. We all want to get our little check
get the
mark,
gold
right?
star.
The gold
Exactly,
star, right?
exactly.
Great. And I see this as especially people who, I think the intention is to be precise and to really, be thorough. So it actually comes from being from intellectual honesty, as much as, also like just not being aware of, but the real, the question underneath the question is the fascinating part.
It is, and I think it comes back to some of these core kind of, kind of what we commonly refer to as like soft skills, right? But which I think really undersells the importance of these skills, particularly in our modern environment. Being able to get the subtext, right? So it's like, yes, it's the question behind the question, but it's picking up on cues from somebody that they're concerned, right? They're like, maybe you, to your point, maybe you answer their question, but you haven't actually picked up on something that they're really worried about, and because you haven't asked, right? And so I think it is this, it's this kind of real ninja skill, the people that are able to see and understand like, oh, there's something else going on here emotionally for this person, and I don't quite know what it is, and so I'm gonna try to ask them a question
Yeah.
to
And I think the one of the drivers behind that is the cultural zeitgeist that I've prepared this presentation, or I have, like in my case, sometimes I fall in love with my own product. And
sure.
so even though the product encourages human curiosity, if I don't manage it, I could just talk about the product and how amazing it is for this customer or that customer. And so I get caught up in that narrative versus kind of triangulating back and, making sure that, we're addressing what are the questions that may be relevant for customers, because I'm trying to complete this demo, or I'm trying to show everything that I have on the plate. Again, the intention is good, but the challenge, I think, that we live broadly, and, we could come back to how we unlock it, but we live in a culture where there is a glorification of sharing, right? Like whether it's on social, most like, look at me, or I have this or that idea, or like it feels like there the emphasis on the whole is a thought is to be seen as a thought leader. And it's almost like what you're probably proposing is like to be a great thought leader, you need to be, asking great questions first. And then, that may lead to actual breakthrough. And it's sort of probably the way the mind, the like if picking the right questions out of a bunch of questions is, and sequencing them seems to be the right approach. So what's your take on that and framework of, okay, let's say I took my breath, whether the situation is stressful or kind of just a general opportunity, I could say, hey, there's something I could learn here. If my heart is pumping, there's some curiosity there for me, like what's there to learn. But then how do I make sure at that point that I r ask the right questions?
So I think in the moment, you may not, I think, let me just say this. There's like a, I think if you're in the moment, you're taking a pause and you're even taking the time to ask a question, that is a win, right? And so that is like great. You're trying, you're doing it. If you have a little bit more time, if you're able to kind of even in that moment say, okay, I'm really curious about this. I want to take, again, it depends on the context, but if you have 5 minutes, then what you can do is explore three different parts of the question, or three different filters, I would say, to really understand, is this the right question? The first one is probably the most important one, and that is, are you asking a question that is expansive? And what I mean by that is your question a binary question? A lot of times we are asking yes/no questions, questions that have a yes/no answer. We're not even aware of it. But what you're doing in that case is you're artificially limiting the possibilities, for solutions, for futures, right? And so, first, really understanding, okay, is this a binary question? If not, how do I reframe this question so it is more open? And I'll take the example, that I shared earlier from my own life, which was I was asking this question of, should I get a divorce? Realized, not the right question, because yes wasn't the right answer for me. I didn't want to get a divorce. No also wasn't the right answer because it didn't acknowledge the very real problems at the heart of my relationship. And so I ended up changing that question to something like, how would I have to change and how would my partner have to change in order for us to stay together? And so this opened up a totally different conversation, a totally different kind of set of ideas and possibilities for what the future could look like for us. The second thing, so we have expansive as number one. The second piece of
So
it is,
sometimes people use open-ended question. Is that similar? Like, is that a similar as expensive, or that's just too narrow? Like too narrow.
yeah, I think open-ended is another way of describing, I think, yeah, it's a similar way of describing expansive. But I would say, making sure that you can't, it's not a simple yes or no answer. It's something that's going to, that feels like there's a lot of room for ideas in there.
And is open, like I guess to, like not to nitpick the words, but it does feel like open, like expensive feels more like you're creating more outcomes. Open-ended could still be pretty shallow. It's like it's more like tell me more about this, right, type of question. Whereas expensive, it actually like ref it almost feels like what you've just done is reframes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Open-ended doesn't necessarily reframe. It just the expense the what you've described feels to me is like closer to the question that gets a lot more insight, and maybe like the reframe questions come after the more open-ended, like tell me more about how you're feeling, and then I think the real question is not yes or no, it's like how can we adapt ourselves, right? Is that the sequence?
I think that's right. I think that sounds right to me. I think the other piece of it that kind of flows into in the second filter that you can use is, does this question serve as a kind of internal GPS? And what I mean by that is this even your question, or is this a question that someone else is putting pressure on you to answer, but that doesn't actually, you know, I think if it's a personal question, you can think about, does this lead back to my values? If it's a professional question, you think about the values of your organization, right? Like, does this actually lead back to something that is core to what we want to do, to who we are? Or is this just a question in the zeitgeist that somehow we've felt pressure to try to answer, right? And so I think
Got it.
there's this, there's that that
Fairness, it's a value-based, it sort of almost says, I like one of my favorite phrases to my team is play stupid games, win stupid prizes. And this is this what you're describing. This question is to make sure that you're not playing stupid somebody else's games, right? That are kind of
exactly.
inherited that you haven't reflected on.
Exactly. It's just like, does this, is this question like guiding you back to your North Star, right? And if not, pick a different question. So that's number two. Number
So
three.
in the context of a potential divorce, like and let's say you have maybe kids on the way, or you want to have kids, or like there is this like is the question of yes or no the right one for the unit, and for us, right? And whether you divorce or not divorce, you may still need to navigate through how do you support kids as an example for the
Totally.
parents, right? So that's a more like reframing it from like what would make me happy or what would make me afraid of this is like what's the right way for all the stakeholders in this situation to get to a better place, right? That's what I'm hearing. Okay, got it. So
Absolutely. And I think, you know, in some cases, I will say too, like in some cases, the yes or no, what I'm sharing is not meant to be a one size fits all. You know, it's like, you know, there might be some cases in your life where you're like, you know what, to take the relationship that I'm in an abusive relationship, yes, I should get a divorce. You know, like I'm not intending in any way to say, oh, this is gonna be true for you in any, but I think that you will know, right? As you're going through this exercise of what question is going to feel right to you, and where you might need to expand and where you might need to reframe, versus something that that you know you can answer pretty simply.
So expect value-based questions, and then the third one.
And the third one is it moving you forward? And what I mean by that is, I have a whole framework in the book about kind of different types of questions. And I relate different types of questions to parts of a fruit tree. And we can get into that if you'd like. But one part of the tree are dead leaves, dead leaf questions. And these are the questions that they don't serve you anymore. You should just release them, you should let them go.
Let it go.
And these are the questions that are like, they're keeping you stuck in the past. So it's, you know, why didn't we do this? Why did we break up? What if I had just done this? Those patterns of rumination and
Rumination is the key word, right? This is the rumination.
exactly. And so if you're asking a question like that, that's a pretty good signal that, you know, this is not the right question for you because it's not helping you move forward. It's not helping you see different possibilities, different answers, different solutions. So that's another case where it's
Right.
time to read the question.
It's October, November, dead leaves. Let's out. So that's easy. Let's go
Yes.
through the other questions, right? Like, because I think that's really helpful. A lot of people get stuck in that. Why didn't they raise money at that time? Why didn't we do this, that? The, like, whether it's in business or personal, I think that's a very common trap, especially
It is.
high standards. And we somehow, as life progresses, we don't meet these standards. I think that's easy to get caught in.
Totally, totally. And it's just not help, you know, it's not, you know, you think about how is this question actually serving me? It's probably not. And so you might be able to ask a better, you know, a question for you might be, well, what did I learn from that that I can carry forward, you know? And so then you're not kind of staying stuck and you're just thinking about applying it to future circumstances.
So let's go through through the tree framework.
Sure. So a big part of the book is, okay, if you want to change your relationship to uncertainty, you've got to change your relationship to the questions in your life. And how do you change your relationship to questions? Well, you get to know them better. You are able to kind of calibrate your expectations for those questions. And what I mean by that is, a question like, what am I going to have for dinner tonight is very different from a question like, who am I? Right. And so we need to be able to understand what type of question are we asking and what type of expectation do we have for when we can get an answer or what type of question this is. So the framework is, there are kind of four different parts of it. The first part or the first type of question in the framework is a peach question. And what I mean by that is, think about a peach ripens pretty quickly on the tree. These are the types of questions that you're going to get an answer to pretty quickly. So maybe it's a question like, will I get the job, right? You're going to know in a few weeks if you get the job, or maybe if you're making you're trying to figure out if you're going to get like the next seed round, right? Okay, you're going to find out, and you're going to find out fairly soon. So that's a peach style question. The second type of question is a pawpaw question. Now, pawpaw fruit takes 5 to 7 years to ripen on a tree. So these are the questions that are going to take you a little bit more time to answer. So maybe it's a question about whether a new venture is going to succeed, whether a new career pivot is going to help you find that kind of sense of meaning and purpose that you're craving in your life. The third type of question is the heartwood question. Now, heartwood is the part of the tree. It's actually kind of the center or the core of the tree. It stays with the tree for its entire life, lending the tree its stability, helping it kind of come back to that sense of equilibrium. And that's the same for your heartwood questions. So these are the questions that they're never really permanently answerable, but rather they evolve, they change with you across your life. So these are the questions like, how do I live a life of meaning and purpose, right? How do I balance high performance with well-being? Who am I, right? All of these might be some of your heartwood questions. The fourth type of question we already talked about, those are the deadly questions. Those are the questions that you can release, keeping you stuck in the past. So that's the basics
So
of the
what's the biggest, like, let's say deadwood is obvious, all right? Like
dead leaves,
we
yeah.
could probably save like 50% of our time, in our Western society if we weren't worrying about that. What is the biggest opportunity for people that they miss today, so that our audience could say, hey, if I, besides getting the book and getting into it, like, what's the one takeaway that you would recommend for people to be more reflective between these three types of remaining questions?
Yeah, so I think when it comes to the pawpaw questions and the heartwood questions, those are the ones where, we might feel a lot of pressure and urgency to get those answered. But I think recognizing that, A, they might never be answerable, or B, it might take some time to answer, that's a really powerful realization for your own process in terms of being able to get a little bit more patient, right? And I have a whole chapter in the book about how do we cultivate patience, this like virtue that feels very old school, right? But is really important. And so I think when you recognize that, okay, it might take me some time to answer this, or this might never be answerable, how does that change the way that you approach the situation, the way you try to seek answers? That can be a transformative process because you are, instead of in these moments where you might feel like you really need an answer right now, instead of just like clinging to the first answer that comes up, you can give yourself a little bit more time, and in that time and space, find a path or an answer or solution that's ultimately going to be a lot better for you than the thing that just came up immediately. So I think that's what kind of changing those expectations on the front end helps you sit with those questions for a little bit longer. And I have a whole framework and kind of a process called the questions map and questions practice to help people do that. That's what it can give you on the back end, that greater clarity and hopefully better answers and more kind of expansive set of possibilities.
Well, amazing. So I think you could actually discover the meaning of life and be patient enough to get to it. Not be attached if you don't get to it right away. If
Right.
you buy the book, Elizabeth, how can people find you in the book so that
Yeah.
we explore this more?
Well, I appreciate it. You can find the book wherever books are sold, Amazon, Bookshop, Barnes and Noble, to name a few places that carry it. You can go to my website, elizabethweingarten.com, and I'm also on Substack. So at Time Travel for Beginners is my Substack. So find me in any of those places.
Amazing. As we wrap up, Elizabeth, one final piece of wisdom for those that want to bring more curiosity and questions into their lives.
Yeah. Think about your questions. Think about forming a different relationship to your questions. Like, what would it look like for you to start to treat a question in your life like you would treat a person? So that's the reflection that I would leave people with. And I think that is core to this poet Rilke, and what he wants us to leave with. But that's the big reframe, I think, around curiosity and questions.
That's the mic drop. So anthropomorphize your questions.
Yes, totally,
Give them a
totally.
name. What would Elizabeth, my friend Elizabeth, ask about this question? Amazing. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us. It was a lot of fun, and I have a lot more questions to ask, but we can't continue forever. But please welcome back to the podcast, and we'll bring more questions from our audience next time.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me, Alex. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you. Welcome back. Alex Shevelenko here. Thank you so much for listening to Experience Focused Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at podcast.relayto.com, RELYTO.com. Obviously, we would love for you to send this to people that you know who would be great speakers, or just share the nuggets that you took away from this episode with your community on social. And you could learn more about what we're up to on relayto.com. You could certainly connect with me on LinkedIn, where it's just very easy to spell my name. You have to have a master's in Ukrainian. It's Shevelenko, Shevelenko. Would love to connect so that we can move together the way the world communicates about its most important ideas. Thank you for listening. We hope to see you next time.